I firmly believe that this is a musical score. It's a piece of music. When I go back and listen to the peasant slave speech, I'm going to listen to it and I'm going to hear things that are off, not just based on the text, but based on rhythm, based on tempo, based on phrasing, inflection, and I'll hear where that has gone awry. And I definitely believe that it's a musical score that is very, very carefully crafted.
Hello and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And in the studio today we have Marcus Potter. Hello, Marcus.
Howdy, folks. It's great to be here today with you talking some Shakespeare.
I love it. Marcus is an actor about town, and he has appeared in such great plays as You Like It at the Weston Playhouse, Edgar in King Lear at the Denver Center, Laertes in Hamlet at the Guthrie Theater, and Demetrius in A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Long Wharf Theater, among many, many others. And we are glad to have him on the show. Thanks, Marcus.
Thanks so much. Great to be here, guys. Thank you.
To start with, we always like to ask our guests, why this piece?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, for one, I'm going to be doing Oh, What a Rogue and Peasant Slave from Hamlet. It's the beast, one of the beasts of Shakespeare. And it's got an incredible range. The stakes are extraordinarily high. It has some really interesting language things in it that I figured would be fun to talk about. And it's the Iron Man of Shakespeare. So I thought I'd dive head in and just go for broke.
When you say Iron Man, are you referring to its length?
Well, it does happen to be a little longer, but the range that he goes through and the discovery that he makes and where the stakes are so enormous.
I also was noticing that it comes at the end of an incredibly long, long scene. And to deliver this monologue at the end of a scene, we're at line 600 by the end.
And Shakespeare brilliantly comments on that before the soliloquy begins. Hamlet says, "Now I am alone." And finally, this guy is there to speak about these enormous epic things that have been happening, and there he is finally with some peace and quiet,
able to think,
able to process, able to figure it out, able to find out what to do next.
What's happening in the moment before he speaks?
Well, the player king and queen have just put on a performance, and one of the lead actors is crying and weeping. That actor that he sees is so in the moment, he's so present, and he has so much raw emotion that Hamlet wishes that he would have for the death of his father who has been murdered.
Has he been able to grieve? I mean, has he had the space and the time?
No, absolutely not. His new stepfather has constantly been trying to cheer him up, bringing his old college buddies, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, to talk to him. There's the hustle and bustle of the castle. Things are happening everywhere. So wherever you turn, there's your dead father popping up. There's Ophelia, my girlfriend. There's my mom. There's just so much happening and a lot to deal with.
The idea of Shakespeare's playing in Hamlet was what it is to be an actor and the theater. You know, the speak the speech is used as the primer to how to act Shakespeare. And now he spends a lot of time talking about the emotional content. I just find it fascinating that Shakespeare is so self-referential.
We always think of Brecht as being the one to speak about theater, you know, the alienation effect and the audience becoming aware of what the actors are doing. But clearly Shakespeare is doing this centuries before. Shakespeare is making us aware of the theater. He's making us aware of actors, clearly very consciously.
Would you like to just jump in and speak the words for us?
Sure.
This is Marcus Potter doing Hamlet from Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2.
Now I am alone. Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working all his visage wand, tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and his whole function suiting with forms to his conceit, and all for nothing? For Hecuba? What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba, that he should weep for her? What would he do, had he the motive and the cue for passion that I have? He would drown the stage with tears, and cleave the general ear with horrid speech, make mad the guilty and appall the free, confound the ignorant and amaze indeed the very faculties of eyes and ears. Yet I, a dull and muddy meddled rascal, peak like John o' Dreams, unpregnant of my cause, and can say nothing. No, not for a king upon whose property and most dear life a damned defeat was made. Am I a coward? Who calls me villain? Breaks my paint across, plucks off my beard and blows it in my face, tweaks me by the nose, gives me the lie in the throat as deep as to the lungs. Who does me this, huh? Swoons, I should take it. For it cannot be, but I am pigeon-livered and lack gall to make oppression bitter. Or ere this, I should have fatted all the region kites with this slave's awful bloody body villain. Remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, kindless villain! Oh, vengeance! Why, what an ass am I? This is most brave, that I, the son of a dear father murdered, prompted to my revenge by heaven and hell, must like a whore unpack my heart with words, and fall a-cursing like a very drab, a scullion. Fie upon it! Fah! About my brain. I have heard that guilty creatures sitting at a play have, by the very cunning of the scene, been struck so to the soul that presently they have proclaimed their malefactions. For murder, though it have no tongue, will speak with most miraculous organ. I'll have these players play something like the murder of my father before mine uncle. I'll observe his looks. I'll tend him to the quick. If he do blench, I know my course. The spirit that I have seen may be the devil, and the devil hath power to assume a pleasing shape. Yea, and perhaps out of my weakness and my melancholy, as he is very potent with such spirits, abuses me to damn me. I'll have grounds more relative than this. The play's the thing, wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Marcus. That
definitely
was great.
Yeah.
How do you feel after going through a marathon speech like that?
It's exhausting. I can't imagine Hamlet going through the grief and suffering and trying to overcome his greatest fear and greatest weaknesses and trying to find himself as a man. You know, that can be indeed, as you said, a marathon.
What's the biggest challenge in doing this speech?
Doing it just now, I realized the discoveries. I feel like I want to keep the language moving, yet so much new information is discovered that finding those truthfully, authentically, and using the technique to keep the speech moving and alive and on your fingertips without it getting indulgent can be a double-edged sword.
When you're preparing a text for performance, what are the first things that you do?
Well, first thing is know what the heck I'm talking about, right? A lot of times we take for granted, we think we know what things mean based on our current, how we use language currently, but I think it's really important, even small words, to go back to the lexicons and find out what individual words mean. And then I'll know if I can transpose it line by line in contemporary current English versus Shakespeare's words. So I'll take one line and then transpose it with my own words back to back and make sure that I'm that specific and clear about the meaning.
That's a very interesting approach that no one else has talked about. So you actually transpose all of the text into your own words. What would that sound like?
Yeah, line by line. So for example, oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. Oh, what a disgusting, low-class piece of crap I am. Is it not monstrous that this player here, isn't it insane that this actor here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, in his own made-up world, in his own little play, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So you're talking about paraphrasing the verse?
Yeah. And again, that can minimize what Shakespeare's trying to say, because a lot of times there's three, four meanings in one line. So if we were to paraphrase, you could go on for a paragraph. But I just like to simplify just so I really am certain that I know what I'm meaning to say with specificity.
What does that do for you as an actor?
Oh, it's completely freeing. I'm no longer locked into what my idea of the verse is. It makes it more tangible, more gritty, more authentic for myself.
A lot of our guests talk about what is the thought, and I imagine that helps you get to the root of what the thought of the character is.
Definitely. One of the biggest mistakes I think that people who speak verse do is they fragment thoughts. And these thoughts are more intelligent, they're less Twitter, and they're longer. They can go on for four sentences. Our instinct is to get a thought to end very quickly, to speak in short, clipped phrases where we have to follow the thought to the end.
OMG, WTF. You mentioned in our prep conversation that you were interested in how line endings were played in the speech.
Yeah, absolutely. There are some really interesting points. For example, there's the line, "the very faculties of eyes and ears, period, same line, yet I." So I made the choice to take the beat after "yet I" rather than taking the beat before "yet I." So reading it as, "confound the ignorant and amaze indeed the very faculties of eyes and ears, yet I, beat." Where a lot of times I hear it as, "confound the ignorant and amaze indeed the very faculties of eyes and ears. Yet I, a dull and muddy metal." You see how it breaks the speech there? It breaks the meter? And I think Shakespeare, it was a clue that Shakespeare wanted you to go on quickly so that the thoughts are coming to Hamlet before he even knows what to say.
We're talking about line 565 and 566 in particular. He's thinking super fast at this point.
Yeah, it's a crisis. He has to come up with a solution. He has to figure out what to do very, very quickly.
There's something to the repetition of the sound I used in two instances. It's a homonym, right?
Ah.
The very faculty of eyes and ears, yet I.
Absolutely. And, you know, as we all know, usually pronouns in Shakespeare are extraordinarily boring, redundant. Currently, we use pronouns in contemporary speech, but in Shakespeare's speech, the pronouns can get exhausting. But this is an example of where I versus this dude over here is meant to be pointed out.
The speech, as we mentioned earlier, is rife with midline stops, meaning places where the verse would continue to the end of the line, but there is punctuation intermittently. How do you treat that?
Well, at first glance, you think of it thought by thought, but then you realize in a mid-stop, you have three quick thoughts that are really setting up a larger idea. So a mid-stop isn't the way we would conclude a certain thought. There can be a little bit of a forward momentum to it. Like it's its own individual idea, but it's also connected to the next.
You're talking about how do you bridge those as an actor and keep the thought going and also pay attention to the text.
Right. And you'll notice when the speech went on, I did use a few of the mid-stops because I felt like I had to. So there's no, I think, hard and fast rule about it. You know, it's a mid-stop, so I have to race through it. It's just you have to be aware of it, I think, and pay attention that there is a mid-stop. Whether I choose to take a beat there or not is up to me in terms of the storytelling.
At what point in your process do you begin to be conscious of the breath, or are you?
Yeah, it really depends. I like to let the breath take care of itself based on the ideas. And I think if you are really in tune and in sync with Shakespeare's meaning and his words, I think you'll breathe where you're supposed to breathe. But with that said, when speaking verse for the first time, you have to have a larger lung capacity or you will fizzle out very, very, very quickly. So if I'm noticing that I'm running out of air and my thought isn't over yet, that's either one or two problems. One, I'm not breathing in the right spot, and then I will go technically in and say, oh, no, I need to breathe here and take a bigger breath here. Or that's a clue that something else isn't working. Either my connection to the material or the meaning or knowing in detail what I'm doing.
When you prepare to do Shakespeare on stage, do you consult different sources?
Yeah, I'll definitely go to the First Folio will be my first go-to source. And then I think we can possibly get a little bit too smart for ourselves. We have no idea why something was in the First Folio, second, third, etc. We just don't know. But what we can do is we can at least see what was written, what the differences are, and choose what's more interesting and when what makes more sense. So that's how I'll make a decision.
It sounds to a certain extent like you're saying, do the work, do the due diligence of looking at the folio, but then trust yourself, trust your own instincts as the actor playing the role.
Totally. And not only instincts, but I think you can be a craftsman and choose and select. It's like choosing your palette. Ah, I like this, let's use that. Let's bring this into the fold.
Looking at the folio, I don't think you're using a folio version.
No.
And I wasn't using a folio version, but looking at the folio, there's some amazing differences in the speech, including one less short line and a lot of different words. And some of the words are just spelling issues between the folio and archaic spellings, but there's a couple words that we can talk about. One for sure is on line 583, right after O Vengeance. Non-folio, it says, why, what an ass am I? But the folio, the first word is who? Which seems to be a continuation of his previous section of the text, which is who plucks off my beard and blows in my face, tweaks me by the nose. Interesting.
If you want me to tell you why, I have no bloody clue.
I think here at the State of Shakespeare, we're far less interested in why and far more interested in how does it change your reading of the text?
You know, if you give me a who after O Vengeance, I think there's a lot of different ways you could go with that. But I would have to really just explore, experiment, try it out, try it on for size, and see what it did. The options are endless.
One of the big differences that I noticed was lines 588 and 589. In the version I had, after fie upon it foe, that was the end of the line.
Uh-huh.
And then it started another new line about my brain, hum I've heard, and that was the end of that line. So those are two short lines in a row, and those are two short lines that don't exist in the folio. What do you think's going on there?
Well, after he says, this is line 588, a scullion, fie upon it, foe. And then rather than about my brain being at the beginning of the next line, about my brain is within that same line, which indicates to me the urgency of let's go, let's move, let's get an idea. I need to get it fast. And that just shows me the urgency about my brain, go. As opposed to taking any type of a beat before that.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting thing because given the opportunity to have a short line there after about my brain, then he's thinking, some actors might take some time to think. And I love your take on it, that he's like moving. And again, in the folio, talk about words. In the folio, it's scullion, not stallion in the beginning of that line. And stallion gives the idea of a horse. Scullion gives the idea of like a maid cleaning dishes in a
scullery maid.
And a horse is a much quicker thing.
Right.
So it's just an interesting difference there.
It's a very interesting difference because the editors who divide that line into two lines are leaving the actor space to consider what the next move might be and have this discovery that one of the ways to do this is to set the mousetrap. Editors who resist that notion may be thinking that Hamlet already has an idea of what he's going to do because he's already spoken to the player King and told him that in tomorrow's performance, he's going to insert some lines. So he may already have thought of the mousetrap, so why have him make that discovery twice? So it's a very, very tricky distinction, and I think that that is one of the places where perhaps editors play director.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think leaving the empty lines and making those very minimal and specific are really important. After O Vengeance, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. There's a blank. So clearly, after O Vengeance, you're left with what to do next. And there's that gap, that empty verse. And if you add three or four other of those, then it takes away from the significance of all of a sudden, boom, there's a silence.
Yeah, you have to earn that pause, right?
Right.
When faced with a short line, do you have any rules or things that you think about with the short line?
Just filling in what happens in that... Again, that silence. So what's going on? It's not empty.
How does line 584 read in your text?
I have that I, the son of a dear father, murdered.
And in the folio, when we look at line 584, we have that I, the son of the dear murthered.
Mm.
It's an interesting distinction, but I love the folio because you get to say murthered.
Right, yeah.
Anytime Garrett gets a chance to speak archaically, he gets excited.
Yeah, no, that has a nice ring to it. And again, editors might run away from that because, oh, that might be hard to understand. We know what they're saying, but if you say it right, then it'll be very, very clear.
I'm telling you that if you get an opportunity to go on stage and say murdered, you want to grab that opportunity. And the audience is going to, and I think the audience is going to love that as much as you love saying it.
You know, I'm going to challenge you today. Sometime you slip that into your vocabulary. You're at Starbucks. You're going to be talking about somebody that was murdered, and you find a way to use it. I'll be very disappointed if I hear you didn't work that into your vocabulary today.
I'm bringing murdered back. But this is one of the reasons that I like actually doing the scansion, because if you didn't do the scansion and you came across murthered, you'd be tempted to pronounce it murthered.
Mm.
The scansion leads you in a different direction, murdered. It forces you to invest that word with three syllables.
Absolutely.
And in so doing, you invest it with so much more.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what the audience is coming for. They're coming for these epic stories, and they're coming for the language. So you have to treat the language carefully and explore the language and bring the nuances and the pleasure in the language to the forefront.
Marcus, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you so much. It's been a blast.
And thank you for listening to The State of Shakespeare.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.